This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of March the 1st, 2019. I'm Mason King.
Back on the Pete the Planner Show, it's the broke 50-year-old edition of the show. No, I'm not 50 and broke. I'm 40 and I have some money. I used to define financial success as having enough money to do what I want. Now, I define financial success as having as few financial obligations as possible. I want you to pay off your house. If you're a homeowner right now, as long as you pay off your home by 50 and then don't reabsorb that additional cash flow into your lifestyle once you pay it off, you will retire successfully.
And now we're back. This is the IBJ Podcast now with Mason King. And that was Pete the Planner, a.k.a. Peter Dunn of Carmel, Indiana, who over about 15 years has become one of the nation's most prominent providers of financial advice. You can read his books, listen to his podcast or radio show, see him on cable business news shows, or hire him to provide money management advice at your place of business. And beginning March 15th, he will write a regular column for the Indianapolis Business Journal focusing on how to build wealth and keep it. Now, we invited him on the IBJ Podcast to talk about the specific concerns he plans to tackle in his IBJ column, including the many financial threats faced by the middle class and the upper middle class. But I wanted to ask him first about his finances and the business of being Pete the Planner. How do all of the elements of his public persona, his marketing outreach, and core services work together in the Pete the Planner empire, if you will? So here's our conversation. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Mason. It's good to be here.
Hey, is it, do you go Peter or Pete?
50-50, but there's special people in my life that call me Peter. My wife calls me Peter. Most of everyone else calls me Pete. And if the middle name gets involved, it's my mom.
Is that your mom?
Yeah, it's my mom. That's right. Okay. I'm no different than anyone.
All right. So what I want to do here at the beginning, I want to turn the tables on you.
Sure.
A little bit and talk about your finances.
Yeah, have at it.
Now, to the extent you're comfortable, I want to ask about the business of being Pete the Planner. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about Pete the Planner, it, I gather, can get kind of confusing because there is more than one Pete the Planner. Mm-hmm. There is Pete the Planner, you, the person. There is Pete the Planner, the radio show on WIBC.
Correct.
So, the Pete the Planner show is a weekly podcast. You also, or I shouldn't say you, Pete the Planner also is a wide-ranging business.
Absolutely.
Which includes Pete the Planner in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And Pete the Planner is, as you probably can intuit here, folks, is a brand.
Right.
And the brand is you, to an extent. So it's a super interesting, pseudo-vertically oriented business model. So my first question is, to what extent are you a financial planner? I know there's a distinction in here that you can help us with.
Yeah, and I actually love that question because it prevents a lot of trouble from a lot of directions. I was a financial planner, right? And I think the average person actually doesn't understand what a financial planner does and doesn't do. Financial planning is a technical process of which I no longer do, right? Mm. Other people think, most people think, that financial planning is helping people with their finances, which it is, but not technically, right? So I help people with their finances every day. Hundreds of thousands of millions of people a year I help with their finances, and they actually consider me to be their financial planner, but I don't put myself out that way, and I am not a licensed financial planner, and we don't do technical financial planning.
And then, so you would not, for example, have a fiduciary duty to your client?
No, I absolutely do not.
Okay.
But we also don't give securities and investment advice, so that's where that all cancels itself out.
There you go. Okay. How much do you make in a year?
Oh, well, that's a... You really get after it.
How about this?
Yeah,
the Pete the Planner empire.
Sure.
Can you get a sense? Give us a sense of like how much revenue that produces in a year.
We've cracked seven figures as an organization, but we're a bigger organization. We continue to grow. I see that growing even more in the coming years as we're in a market that there's not a lot of competition in. And people are starting to understand the benefit of what it is we do.
So the Pete the Planner empire is, revenue-wise, right now, $1 million plus.
Yeah, I would say this, though, as the owner, the sole owner of that business, I live a comfortable lifestyle, but it's not absurd, right? I think when people read my writing, they sense that I'm not this opulent figure that, this is the advice for you. I do something different because I make too much money. I have two kids. I have a mortgage. I have no car payments because I don't want car payments. I'm on hopefully going to pay for my kids' college education without having student loans for them. So I have very real financial considerations and challenges that my audience also has.
Well, and the business has overhead. You have employees.
Oh, God, yes.
You have office space.
Yeah.
I don't want to imply that you're – you personally are a millionaire.
I do fine. But I also pay myself not as much as I could so that the business can grow. And that's something I've learned over the last 10 or 15 years.
The way that I interpret the brand, and we'll see how effective your branding is, is let me help you fix or fine tune your financial behavior so you can be a millionaire when you retire.
More or less, yes. But the millionaire retirement definitely sounds clickbaity, right? Yeah. I mean, it does, but it's also the most honest thing you're going to hear, because you're going to have to be. If you're in your 20s or 30s or 40s right now and you're listening to this, you absolutely 100% will have to be a millionaire if you don't have a pension. Yeah. No doubt. If you're in your 50s or 60s, 50s probably, 60s, not necessarily. But if you're 20s, 30s, and 40s, which is a lot of my audience, you have to be a millionaire. You have to. And I feel like the idea of, well, I don't aspire to that. Well, you should, because that means that you've done the math and you're going to have to be. So, yeah, I think you hit it.
How does Beat the Planner make money? Number one, looks like I can buy your books.
You can. I mean, I don't make a tremendous amount, or the organization doesn't make a tremendous amount each year on books. You know, tens of thousands, less than 100,000 on books a year.
And again, we're talking about revenue. Just
revenue. Yeah, right. Revenue. Not profit. Yeah. I think six of my books are in Barnes & Noble stores across the country.
What is the one that does the best? What is the bestseller?
There's a series called Your Money Life, and it's your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, your 50s, your 60s. You know what? I should know the bestseller, shouldn't I? I think it's probably 30s or 40s.
You write for publications like you will for the IBJ.
I do. That, despite the fact that money's involved, that's therapy for me. I don't mean to mean those that make a living writing in journalistic publications, but I spend a couple hours a week doing it, and I just really enjoy expressing myself. And most of the financial services industry is built around two concepts: fear and greed. I'm either going to scare you into doing something, or I'm going to stoke these feelings of greed. I like to live in the in-between of those things, yet still find a way to touch someone to change. And it's hard to get someone to change if they're not so broken that they can't go any other direction, or they have such a beautiful vision of what could be. And so I love the challenge of trying to affect change without terrifying people or stoking horrible greed.
So if we look at the revenue from writing for publications, a small percentage of what you do.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. College money for kids. I mean, really, all my media stuff, radio too, right? All goes into my kids' college fund.
Where is the majority of the money made?
So we are an employee benefits company that essentially employers hire us to solve the financial problems of their workforce. So every employer pays us between $9 to $27 a year based on the size of the company to be—
That's per employee.
Per employee. Yeah. To on demand help them with any aspect of their financial life that's not specifically investment related. So we have a series of CFPs and experts all over the country.
What's a CFP?
A certified financial planner. So upper echelon of the financial world, those that do have a fiduciary duty if they're practicing financial planners. People can call, text, or live chat with those experts whenever they want. And we'll talk to them every day. We'll talk to them every week, every month. And we solve very real everyday financial problems.
Well, give me a quick range. It could be something as simple as, hey, I need to buy a car and I'm not sure how to—
How much I can afford.
Yeah, right.
Or should I buy or lease? Hey, we're buying our first house, so how much can I really afford, or how do we structure the mortgage? Or I'm in collections, which I just lost my husband lost his job. What should we do? Should we pay the mortgage, or should we, pay our utility bills? All the way to, I just got a $30,000 bonus. Should I put it towards my kids' college education or towards retirement? So I'd say, Mason, 95% of financial questions 95% have nothing to do with investing. Hmm. And so we answer the 95%. The entire financial planning investment industry can answer the 5%. We'll answer the 95%.
So then what percentage of your revenue in your Beat the Planner empire comes from that business?
Most. I mean, 95. I mean, we're just arbitrarily choosing the number 95 a lot today. But part of that is speaking, right? Part of that is as a voice in the financial industry, in the financial wellness industry specifically, I speak a lot and I get paid to speak around the country. But I mean, I get separated out, but it all goes to that same purpose.
So the speaking and the Beat the Planner in the workplace together, lumped together. That's correct. Really the mother load.
Yeah. Okay.
How long have you offered the Beat the Planner in the workplace package?
So in 2005, when I was a financial planner, I had some wealthy clients here in central Indiana that had some behavioral financial issues. And I found a way to sort of talk them out of the decisions they were making. So they started passing me around their other friends who were wealthy. And I became known as this like fixer for wealthy people that just were making really bad decisions. Well, then that also translated to people who weren't wealthy making bad decisions. And then one of those wealthy clients was high up in an organization. And he said, "Do you think you can do this for my employees?" And I was like, "Of course I can." I couldn't, but I did. This was 2008.
Okay.
So from 2008 to 2012, I had my individual financial planning practice, and then I had this financial wellness practice. And then by 2012, I was like, I'm sick of the individual stuff. So I sold my financial practice in 2012. And so for the last 7 years, I've been fully focused on financial wellness in the workplace.
Okay. And how many people work for you?
Always changing, always growing, because the number of people out in the field. We've got 7 at the home office and then about equal amount sprinkled around the country at any given time. But we're in the midst of probably hiring another 3 to 4. We call them financial concierges out in the field.
Are the majority of your clients still like Central Indiana based, or do you find that there's some serious growth happening outside?
We have very little business in Central Indiana. Right? Most of our business is elsewhere. That being said, we've got some iconic clients. I mean, Pacers Sports and Entertainment, Crew Car Wash. I mean, just real iconic sort of Central Indiana companies that we help them with their workforce.
In many respects, you are the business. And for marketing purposes, that requires you to be a public figure.
Sure.
The Pete the Planner, the brand, is designed so intentionally to feel like very kind of fun and familiar. You're the guy next door who knows a lot about financial planning, and you're happy to come over to my kitchen and tell me what I'm doing wrong. So first, to what degree am I right now experiencing the Pete the Planner persona?
So am I being fake?
Yes. No, not fake.
Yeah.
But presenting yourself in a particular way.
People expect me to have a certain level of energy.
Yeah.
I talk about a topic that's horrendous. Financial planning is a horrible topic, Mason. Horrible.
Tell me about it.
It is. And so my place in this world is to make it palatable. And I do that with energy. And so I'll say this. How I am now, whether this is good or bad, I don't know if this is good for you. I used to be this way all the time. But the more I'm in public, the more I'm on a stage with thousands of people out there or whatever I'm doing, my private time is a lot different than it used to be. I'm the neighbor that no one knows now, where in my younger years, I would be gregarious all the time. I very much value my alone time. I've taken to bass fishing as my, midlife crisis, because it's quiet. There's no screen in front of me and I don't have to talk to anybody.
Where do you go bass fishing?
In Carmel retention ponds. So I like to say they swim in private schools. Well, no, I just like anywhere. I don't even care.
Okay.
It's just such a challenge. But the persona is a thing, but it was crafted these days for a particular reason. I want people to feel like they can get an answer to the question without having to buy anything. Because I really have nothing to sell individuals anymore other than a book. But if someone asks me a question, I'm not going to say, buy my book. What a dumb answer that is. I can just answer them. Like yesterday, I had some free time, so I put on Twitter, "Hey, if you got any financial questions, DM me your phone number. I'll call you and let's talk through it." Like, that's fun to me. It's interesting to me.
Wow.
So,
that's amazing.
I don't know if it's amazing, but it's interesting because I get my finger on the pulse of what people are wondering about.
But you maintain a lot of things. I mean, should we consider this all to be marketing outreach? A podcast, the columns, the.
I want to be a significant member in my community and to do something extraordinary. growing up, I went to Pike High School. I grew up in Central Indiana, and there were just figures in this city who were extraordinary. You saw them, something's different about them, like the way they give and they think about their city. And my effort to do that involves helping who needs help. The financial services industry was really built to help people with money. I'm built to help people who don't have money, and that's not charity. It's empowerment and a little know-how.
So you mentioned that you're from Pike, and you went to which college?
I went to Hanover College, okay. Same as the vice president and the governor and Woody Harrelson.
What did you study at Hanover?
Well, of course, it's a liberal arts school, which I didn't realize until my junior year. Someone was like, man, liberal arts school is different than I thought. And I was like, what? Say what now? They're like, liberal arts school. And I'm like, where? And they're like, here. And I'm like, really? That's true. But I had a business administration major mm-hmm. with my liberal arts degree.
Okay.
Yeah. I love my liberal arts degree, though. I feel like it makes me a more diverse thinker. I feel like, you know, I took theology classes and philosophy classes and geology because I needed a science credit and things like that, which I think make me think differently.
And you came to this also with some theatrical experience.
Kind of. Yeah. Comedy. Yeah. I mean, I was a kid actor. I went doing shows at like Christian Theological Seminary when I was a little kid, second, third grade. In college, I joined a comedy troupe just for fun. Came back to Indianapolis after graduating and started doing improv comedy. Around 2004, the recently befelled Nouveau News Weekly recognized me as an up-and-coming comedian. And it was at that point I was like, this sounds really terrible what I'm about to say. That's sad. So I stopped doing comedy as soon as they named me an up-and-coming comedian because I was trying to – I had my financial planning career going, and then on the weekends I would do comedy. And for some reason in my head, those two things didn't jibe, that I'm being recognized for comedy, but I hadn't really done much in my financial career, so I stopped doing comedy. About a year later, that's where the Pete the Planner brand actually developed of, what if I slap the two together? What if I stop trying to be like this guy during the week and then I let loose on the weekends? And that is really the origin story of Pete the Planner.
And that was about?
2005-ish, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you about what you have planned for the IBJ. You'll be writing for us biweekly?
I think so. Does that mean every other week, or does that mean?
No, my editor asked me the same question. It means every other week, I think.
You know, I had to say I wrote that joke in a USA Today column like 2 or 3 weeks ago. I was making a point about pay frequency, and I said biweekly, and then parenthetically I put, I had to look up whether that was. And I got an angry email from this person that said, I can't believe Gannett would hire a person that doesn't know the difference. And that's when I realized that sometimes humor doesn't translate into ink.
Yeah.
But anyway, every other week I'll be writing. Totally different audience. And here's my mission. This is actually the mission of what we do as an organization anyway. We know that the middle class is really struggling. Like, we know that. And we want to help them. But the people most at risk going forward is the people in the upper middle class who could go either way. They could climb their way to the upper class and probably be insulated from financial ills, or they could fall into the ocean of the middle class. And these are people that household income exceeds $100,000 a year, which especially in the Midwest, you're basically a Rockefeller, into high six figures. And it's their decisions, their consumer decisions, their willingness to fund college or not fund college, to have a $700 a month car lease versus just own your car and have it be 5 years old. These sorts of decisions, which Mason, don't mistake for a frugality, these sorts of decisions will impact them for the rest of their lives. And I want to save as many people as I can from falling from the upper middle class into financial fragility. And that is a very real problem.
Let's say that I'm in the upper middle class.
Okay.
What, for example, could befall me?
There's four big things that people deal with today. People buy bigger homes than they did decades ago. In fact, the 1950s, new homes being built were one-third of the size of new homes being built today. And our family units are actually smaller now than they were in the 1950s. So you've got... So the consumer behavior culturally of home ownership. Car buying is another massive thing. The average car payment's north of $530 a month now on a 73-month note. That's crazy to me, right? You've got youth travel sports, which is a cultural phenomenon where, well, I'm doing this so my kid can get a scholarship. And it's not until the kid's 12 and you realize little Billy's terrible at soccer. Billy should be studying. And by the way, the thousands you've put into youth travel sports probably should have gone into a college savings fund. And then the fourth element really gets into things like entertainment culture, iPhones, things we call the new necessities, right? iPhones, streaming services, satellites. These are things, satellite programming on your television. These are things that 20 years ago didn't exist. So Mason, I would argue there are $500 to $600 a month of expenses in the average household that just didn't exist 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And don't forget the disappearing pension, right? The problem for someone who works at Lilly versus the problem that someone that works at a mid-sized company in central Indiana are completely, completely different problems based on pensions.
I'm glad you brought up youth sports. Okay. Because I don't think it's something that gets a lot of attention. And I've seen siblings who have kids. Spent all of their time out on the road, essentially.
Sure. Yeah.
And I've always been interested, since I now have a toddler at home, in what the benefit is. I mean, in the end, bottom line, what is the benefit of investing so much of your time and money in this pursuit?
My daughter is in youth travel sports, and two different, soccer and gymnastics, right? I mean, and this week I was at Grand Park watching an indoor practice of hers, which is now youth sports mecca. Right. And I think that really goes to the perspective I hope to offer in the IBJ, is that here's this large group of upper middle class people with fine incomes that can we really afford everything we're doing? Because we have a finite amount of income and a finite number of years to earn that income. So if we're trying to provide for a financial past, which is the debts we've incurred, our financial present, which is our lifestyle, and a financial future is retirement, do we really make enough to do all of that? I mean, that's to your question.
Yeah. And the other thing you didn't mention, but I'm sure is part of it, is some sort of catastrophic medical problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean,
cancers and, not to name a bunch of afflictions, but anything that can just wreck you with a six-figure medical bill that no one can recover from. I went in for some tests. I'm fine, everybody. Don't wreck your car. I'm fine. I went in for some tests like 6 weeks ago. I'm sitting in the waiting room. And I'm just looking at my insurance card, and I turned it over, and I'm starting reading the limits. And I'm about to go get some tests to find out if I'm okay, which I am. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, if this goes the wrong way, we're done. Mm-hmm. Like, I've done a lot to prepare. We make a nice income. We've got plenty saved, but we're done. That's financial fragility, and I feel like it extends into the upper middle class, and people either don't realize it or ignoring it or don't care. And so I don't know which of those three things I'm going to be able to affect with my writing, but damn sure going to try.
And we're going to jump right into that with the first column.
Absolutely. First column is we all have one of two paths we must choose with our financial future. This sounds very Lord of the Rings-ish, although I don't read that sort of stuff. But here's how it works. Your plan can involve having a lot of money, right? Like, I'm going to retire because I have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And I would guess, and this is just completely anecdotal, a vast majority of Americans feel like if they are to successfully retire, it's going to be because they've accumulated a lot of money, right? The other choice is the future for the middle and upper middle class, and that is to create an environment in which you don't need a lot of money. Now, this sounds like semantics. It sounds like I'm being cute. And trust me, if you see me, I could never be cute. This is about saying, am I going to grow my appetite for money in an increasing nature as my income continues, which is called lifestyle creep? Or when I hit my early 50s, am I going to smooth out my lifestyle so that as I approach my 60s, I'm already living my retirement lifestyle in my 50s for the income that will be available in my 60s. Mm. And as we talk about people's health getting better, as we watch financial commercials during golf tournaments on TV and you see the lifestyle of the well-heeled 50-something, they're living this increased lifestyle, which will lead to financial ruin because of the math not working. Mm. So the column is about this idea that you got to go to your financial advisor and tell her, look, my plan is to have a lot of money, so let's get after this. Or I want to choose the path of not needing a lot of money, which may mean having my house paid off, which may mean not taking out Parent Plus loans for my kid's education, which, Mason, then affects another bigger issue of when my kid's 17, we're having a come to Jesus meeting about what it means to go to Notre Dame versus what it means to go to IU versus what it means to go to IUPUI. And how that affects their life in the short, mid, and long term, and how it affects my life as someone who will be forced to take on Parent Plus loans if they cap out on student loans. And let me add this, at the risk of alienating everyone listening, that's a conversation of not taking on Parent Plus loans that some very powerful people have not thought through. The Vice President of the United States has six figures worth of Parent Plus loans. The former Governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, has $339,000 in Parent Plus loans because they capped out, their kids capped out on the number of student loans they could have. Mm-hmm.
Let's say that I had a friend who...
Is that the right to assume you have a friend? This just got weird.
I mean, the only friends I have are the people I work with.
Okay, so sure,
sure. Let's just say it's me.
Acquaintances.
Let's say it's me, because I don't have any friends. And so I have a 3-year-old who's going to be in college when I'm 70.
Yeah.
And so we're doing the 529.
Good for you, by the way.
All that stuff, you know. Yeah, well, thanks.
Yeah.
But so we're saving.
Yeah.
We're saving. But also trying to kind of flatten out, mm-hmm. as you say, our expenses, making sure everything is paid for right now.
Our situations aren't terribly different. I mean, I've got a 6-year-old right now. I'm 41. Our plan involves saving aggressively for college, also having our mortgage paid off by the time kids go to college so that we can cash flow what's left over. And it goes back to my earlier point, resolving when my son, who's our youngest, gets to 17 or 18, saying, look, these are your college choices based on where you got into, because mom and I are not going to take out any money for you. What a lot of parents do, they say, well, go wherever you want. I don't care. We're not paying. And so that's a terrible mistake. Because then the kid's a junior, they run out of funds they can borrow, and so the kid either goes home with no degree and a ton of debt, or mom and dad say, oh, we'll sign. And then that's how Parent Plus loans happen. So healthcare is the number one reason people will struggle to retire in the next 5 years. The number two reason is Parent Plus loans. But not to get too off the track here, but in 2025, there's was said to be what's called the enrollment cliff for college education, which is – 15% to 20% reduction in enrollment based on those that are children of the recession. Okay. And so if there's ever a chance for college costs to smooth out and not climb so aggressively, it's between now and 2025. And I think you're already seeing that with the story coming out of Greencastle last week with DePaul laying off so many staff. I think you're starting to see colleges figure out a way that they don't have to raise prices every year.
Well, I can't wait.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, sign me up for that.
Well, I can't wait at least for the column. Welcome aboard.
No, thank you.
Right, and maybe we'll follow up with you here in 6 months or so, and we'll see what you found out.
I'll be here.
All right.
Thanks.
All right. My thanks again to Peter Dunn. Again, you can find his first Pete the Planner column for IBJ in our March 15th issue, which will be online the same day. But before you get on with the rest of your week, I do want to draw your attention to a couple of stories in the current issue. John Russell reveals what has come of the partnership between St. Vincent and Tandem Hospital Partners, which together embarked in 2017 on an aggressive mission to develop tiny neighborhood hospitals around the Indianapolis area. Well, Tandem essentially has fallen apart, leaving St. Vincent scrambling to take over operations of the hospitals. Also in this week's issue, Anthony Shutley reports on the major milestone posted by fledgling Indianapolis-based software company Curano. It has landed a $25 million Series A round of venture capital, believed to be a record for Indiana software companies. So what are these investors expecting from Curano? Anthony explains in this week's issue of IBJ, which you undoubtedly have delivered to your home or office, or you can check out these stories online at IBJ.com. And remember, for full and unfettered access to all of IBJ's award-winning content, just click the subscribe button. Hey, thanks again for making the podcast a part of your week. I'm Mason King, and we'll be back again next Monday.